My guest today is none other than YouTube English teacher sensation, Mr. Salles. If you've heard of Mr. Salles, then you'll know you're in for a treat. If not, then I suggest you look him up, as I can guarantee he'll be helpful to your kids in the years leading up to their exams. Mr. Salles offers tips, guides and suggestions on how to pass English GCSEs. He sits the exams himself to figure out exactly what kids need to do to get the top grades. Then he tells them how to do it. It's as simple as that. So if you have a child who hates English or who feels they aren't good at writing, they need to watch Mr. Salles and read his books, especially his guide to 100% in the AQA English language exam. Welcome back to Brummy Mummies. My name is Zoe Chamberlain. I'm a journalist, author and mum. I launched Brummy Mummies as a community for families to share with you stories from the most inspiring mums and dads to help you find out how they juggle family life and everything that comes with it. A father of two himself, Mr. Salles talks about why he started sharing videos on YouTube and how they went on to have millions of hits. He also shares his own children's experiences in education, plus invaluable advice on how to make the whole learning experience more pleasurable for everyone. So let's get straight into talking to Mr. Salles. Hi, Mr. Salles. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
So it is an absolute pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on.
I'm so glad to have you on here. For anyone who has come across you before, I'm sure that they will be delighted to hear what you have to say. And for anyone who hasn't, then it's great that they're being introduced to you. We came across your videos and your books about a year ago. My son's now getting ready to do his GCSEs. And I have to say, it's the work that you do has been an absolute lifesaver in our house. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to hear.
So tell me about Mr. Salles Teaches English. What inspired you to start this?
So I started, it's over 10 years ago now, and I realised that there was so much more I could teach my students, but having a class of 30 just makes it really difficult. You've got lots of classroom management to do, and it's really hard to maximise the time. And so I thought, anyone who's keen, who wants to get top grades, I do talk a lot, so a 20-minute video. And they would learn as much in a 20-minute video as a whole lesson, and often more than that. And so that sustained me. I started making revision videos. I was head of English, and I'd take half the year group into the library because that's all that would fit. And I'd do a kind of masterclass, tell a kid to record it, and then stick it up on YouTube so they could revise from it at leisure. So that was the genesis. I just realized how useful it was, and it motivated me to keep going because my own students would benefit. And then, of course, you start getting comments on YouTube, which are 99% positive. You know, it's a really supportive platform, totally unlike other social media. And I've stuck with it just because it's enjoyable and useful.
And I'm very glad that you have. So we love the fact that you've actually sat the exams yourself, which I think, unless you do that, I've started to do it with my son and his friends. I'm helping them to do it. And it gives you a real insight as to what's being asked of the pupils.
Exactly.
And do you simplify it? Tell me what I've got to do. And that's what they want to know, don't they, really?
Yeah. I mean, with English, the assessment criteria are so open to subjective interpretation. And Ofqual, who oversee the fairness of exam boards, have done quite an extensive study of exam marking. And they found that English is the least accurate. So a senior examiner and another examiner will only agree 60% of the time on a grade, never mind a mark. So that just tells you that the criteria is far too complex. So I spend a lot of time trying to think through what do you actually have to do so the examiners can't disagree about your mark. And most teachers assume, because they're an expert in the subject, which they are, that obviously their instincts about the exams will be right. But actually, unless you've sat them, you don't realise how much is nothing to do with English and everything to do with the peculiarities of this particular exam. And so I'm super impressed that you sat the exam too, because you will instantly know more than, without disrespecting teachers, than most teachers because they don't tend to do it.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think, as you say, it's because it's so subjective, it's can be quite overwhelming to know where to start, especially if it's not a subject that you're interested in.
Yeah, like your son, I'm assuming. My son was the same. He told me, yeah, sorry, Dad, English is number 9 on my list. I'm only willing to give it like 4 hours. Can you teach me? But I found that I could teach him in 4 hours. So, I mean, it is doable if you don't like it.
Yes. So what are your top tips for students who are revising for their English exams?
So the number one top tip, which trumps everything, is just do practice exam papers. You know, students are super scared of doing that because it's really effortful. And obviously, the result might be disappointing. But if you get a result that you don't like, well, you can just do the question again. You know, it's psychologically, it's harder. But all the research on learning and memory says that, you know, when you do it in this kind of high stakes way, you replicate the exam, you'll just learn more. The other thing I do is if you hate English, you can memorize your question fives for both papers. So you can memorize descriptions of negative and positive settings, negative and positive characters. Make sure it's got the vocabulary, the sentence structure, and crucially, the punctuation that you need. And then you will tick off those assessment objectives as you blend that into whatever the question is. The mistake students make is they try and remember a whole piece and then adapt it, and it's never fully adaptable. But if you've got those four areas of flexibility I talked about, they're 100% adaptable no matter what the question. So I would do that. And then the other thing, which students don't realize, is that I would say about 30% of the marks is writing speed. Like, can you make enough points to get the marks and just develop that? You know, if you're doing an 8-mark question, you've got 12 minutes. Can you write 300 words in those 12 minutes? Because if you can, it's going to be impossible to get less than a grade 7. Typically, what happens is all those reading questions in the language paper are answered on average with a score below 50%, which basically means the kids just aren't writing enough. The questions aren't difficult. You know, it's a test of character, awfully. I mean, I hate that English shouldn't be a test of character, but it is. Can you just keep going? So massively improve your writing speed. And for girls especially, let go of the idea that your handwriting needs to be super neat. It only has to be neat enough to be read, you know? And so sacrifice neatness for speed. And if I want to be sexist about it, boys, don't sit there and think. Like, writing is thinking. So when you're writing in the exam, and if you're writing something that doesn't work, you will instantly spot that and come up with a new idea. Whereas if you think, you'll generate 3 or 4 ideas, reject loads, waste time. And you might come up with a good idea, but you won't have time to write it properly. So I tell my students, writing is thinking, because you'll instantly spot what doesn't work and it will generate a new idea.
Yes, that makes sense. That is a real challenge, isn't it? Getting the words down on the page. I keep finding that with my son, that he's just written 2-paragraph answers and it's just not enough.
No, you've just got to go for, stop thinking about what's the right answer, but think, how can I write as much as possible in my time limit? And that will generate loads of marks. And the other great thing is the examiners never take away marks for stuff that's rubbish, which is unlike other, you know, if you write the wrong definition in science, you're done for. But in English, you can write a paragraph that scores no marks at all, and the examiners will just ignore it and mark what does score marks. So volume really counts.
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes I think that they think, oh, we did one the other day and it got hot. It got 20 minutes left to go. And he said, I'm done. And I said, well, that should be ringing alarm bells that you haven't done enough.
Yeah.
And we came to look at it and it was really short.
So
and
if
he
you go
just
back,
said, I have nothing more to say. So,
this is difficult to demonstrate on a podcast, but I demonstrate to my students something I call the magic finger technique. And so I'll just say to them, right, I'm going to move my finger across the page. It's on the board. Tell me when to stop. And I'll instantly be able to say something about wherever the finger stops. In other words, texts are so rich, you can always write something about anything that's there. It really isn't hard. Another way of doing it is just to think, right, each paragraph is intentionally showing you something new. So just find something to say about each paragraph, you know, and you'll gain marks. So you should never be at a loss of, well, what do I write? Each paragraph tells you.
Yes, because it introduces something new.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, what other tips could you give us for perhaps the other questions? The one that we've just been talking about is the essay question, the creative writing question.
Yeah.
What about some of the essays?
So literature essays, these are an absolute godsend to a student. So the thing about literature, the literature exam, is the ideas in a text aren't conceptually out of anyone's academic reach. So, you know, if I tell you that Priestley's play and Inspector Calls isn't just a protest against capitalism or just in support of socialism, it's also a feminist play that attacks male behaviour in the patriarchal society of the time, and that it's actually an anti-war play, which is why it's set before the First World War and performed at the end of the Second World War. These ideas aren't conceptually difficult. You know, a kid with average intelligence will grasp them. And so then if you think, well, what would I say about those things in order to gain marks? Oh, I know, I'll watch a Mr. Salas video or read a guide. It's not conceptually difficult. The only difficult bit then becomes the skill of, can I organise my ideas into an essay? So any student can genuinely gain top marks in literature if they think carefully about what it is the author's trying to achieve and then just back it up with evidence. Well, again, the evidence is just there in the videos, or it's there in their classwork, or it's there in a revision guide. It's just not hard to get hold of. How do you practice that in your revision? Well, you make notes, put the notes aside, and then do an essay under exam conditions. That tells you how well you can organise your ideas. You check the essay, think, no, I missed out these three quotations or these two ideas. I'll put them in a few days' time. I'll have a go at that essay again, without looking at the notes that I've made to see if I've improved. And that's super easy to do. The other thing that's really easy to do is to narrow down probably 10 to 15 quotations on any text, which will fit all of the author's ideas, so the theme ideas. And what's so brilliant about them is all of them will be attached to a character as well. So if you memorize what you want to write about the themes, they'll fit any question that comes up. You will need some other quotations to flesh it out. So I've done a count of how many quotations grade 9 essays use, and they average 13 to 15. So I've looked at loads of them. So you don't need many quotations. Sadly, teachers in schools tend to train their students to write massive paragraphs about individual quotations to show language analysis. And it's overkill, and it means that they rarely get a chance to embed that many quotations. And so it's a great way to get grades 5 and 6, a terrible way to get higher grades, because you can't cover the whole text when you're zooming in so much on just a few quotations. And so you should only zoom in on stuff once or twice. What you really need to think about is, how do I build an argument that shows how the journey of the text reveals the author's ideas? The wonderful thing about that is it's easy. You just follow the events or the character chronologically. And that gives you an inherent structure, which gives you all the changes because the authors plan them. Like, every text works this way. So if you just follow things through chronologically, you're guaranteed almost a grade 7 or higher.
We're finding your guides really useful. They're much more easy to digest than your average revision guides.
Well, I'm really surprised at that because, you know, I look at it and I think, God, you know, you do write a lot, Tom. You know, so I had a neighbour next door grandmother with her grandson, who's the most bone idle kid you've ever met. And he desperately obviously needed his English. And he ended up getting his highest grades in English. She bought some of my guides and she was like, Mr. Sales, these are just fantastic. They're wonderful. And I was going, great. What does your grandson think? Oh, we don't let him read them. we just translate the ideas for him. And then he goes, and he ended up, like I said, getting his highest grades in English, hated the subject. And I do feel that, you know, is that I write quite a lot. And, you know, a kid who doesn't like reading might just look at the guide and think, well, it's just easier to fail. rather than putting the effort. So I'm delighted that you found them clearer than other guides.
Tell me about how the guides work. Obviously, we know from going through them, but for people that are listening, can you explain how they work? And perhaps for somebody who's panicking about their English language exam, what would be your tips for each of the questions of that exam? What should be the things that they focus on?
Oh, gosh. Right. So,
sorry, I've put you on the spot there.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, I'll try and do that. So if we talk about paper one, language exam, question one is designed for everyone in the country to be able to get 4 marks out of 4. Don't worry about it. Question two is, can you quote and interpret the quote? And like students have been doing that probably since they were in year 5. So really, it's 8 marks. Interpret 8 quotes. You know, most kids will write 2 or 3. Well,
and just to show, so that's from an extract, isn't it? So they have got the quotes there.
Yeah, they've got
a
tiny extract. Just find 8 quotes and say something about all 8. Or if you haven't got time, do 6. And it's genuinely not hard. You know, the skill of writing about 1 is no different than the skill of writing about 8. You just have to write quicker. Do that. Question 3 is the structure question. Nobody knows how to teach that. Well, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, teachers weren't trained in that when they studied. It's kind of new AQA question. And really, all they want you to do is comment on the change of focus in each paragraph. So guess what? You're going to write about 8 paragraphs and say why the focus has changed. And you just make stuff up. I mean, it, you know, as long as it's based on what's in the paragraph, it can't be wrong. And as long as you include paragraph 1 and paragraph 8, you're showing the examiner you've considered the whole text. You'll get full marks, you know. So just do that. Question 4 is a ridiculously artificial, a student said, blah, blah, blah. No real student ever said that. It's just to give you something to write about. The examiners claim that you can completely agree or completely disagree, but I think that's rubbish because they want you to evaluate. And I've looked at loads of answers, and the best thing is to mostly agree and then show a partial disagreement. And again, there's 20 marks, you write 20 points. Simple as that, yeah? And you haven't finished until you've written 20 different things. So it's as easy as that. Question 5. That's 40 marks for a description or a story. Most schools train their students to write a description because it's easier to control. The fact that no author ever sits down and writes 400 to 500 word descriptions in a book seems not to matter to them, which also drives me mad. My advice is write a story unless you're rubbish at stories. In 2022, the picture was the inside of a circular Mexican building. I think it was a kitchen with seating. But because it was circular and Mexican, 90% of students had no idea what they were looking at. And so they wrote the story instead of the description. And for the first time ever, the standard of writing went up. And the examiners commented on this. And they said, oh, it's because more students opted to do the story. And I thought, yeah, no kidding, Sherlock. It's because they didn't do the stupid description question that you force most students to do. So my advice would be, do the story. The marking criteria is just the same, but at least you'll be invested in it as a student, like you'll care what happens, whereas very few kids care about the description they're writing. Why should they? Because like real writers don't do that. If you are going to do the description question, memorize some stuff, like two settings, two characters, negative and positive, as an insurance, so that if you're stuck, you can put those in. There is the artificial element of AO6, which are 16 marks out of the 40, and they're sentence variety and punctuation. Sentence variety is actually, I turn it into a game, try and start each sentence with a different word. And just doing that one thing will improve your writing by 2 grades. It's different words start each sentence, because you will automatically start fiddling about with subordinate clauses and where they go in the sentence and connectives without thinking about it. You're just focusing on, I have to start with a different word. So that's like a superpower of writing, whether it's the story or the description. And the other is quite mechanical. It's like, have I used an exclamation mark, an ellipsis, some brackets? The examiners say, stop teaching the semicolon because every kid uses it incorrectly. But I don't know. But just have a range of 5 bits of punctuation apart from the full stop and the comma, and you'll score those marks unless you make mistakes. But they don't take marks off for making mistakes. So, it's still worth risking. The other thing I train my students to do is question 5 is worth 50% of the marks. Loads of students nationally, and AQA refuse to publish these figures, I've asked them, but loads of students nationally get 4 marks or fewer on question 5, which basically means they've given up at that stage or they've run out of time. And so the schools that I advise, I say, when you do your mocks, train your kids to do question 5 first, and then they don't run out of time. And if they do, it's on an 8-mark question, and they only score 2 marks out of 8, which is, you've lost hardly any, because the average is only 4 out of 8. And so as a tactic, do question 5 first on both papers, and on average you'll score much higher marks because you won't run out of time.
I think that's a brilliant tactic. Yeah.
Then we get to paper 2. Question 1.
Sorry,
again.
Just before we move on to paper 2, could I ask you to tell us the analogy of the break the vase idea? I love that. I think that's so smart.
Yeah, so this came to me from Philip Pullman, who wrote the Northern Lights trilogy. And he obviously used to work as a primary and middle school teacher and, does a lot of training at that stage for primary schools. I went to a literature festival and primary school teachers in the front row said, our students have to write these awful things in their year 6 sats. Although I noticed they still got to write a story. Like better than the GCSE, anyway, with these terrible titles. And he got really excited. He said, I said, that's so easy. He said, just imagine the story, it's the most boring title possible, The Vase. But you want to write something really creative and brilliant. So you just teach the child to say, right, the boy or girl, I'm going to pick boy because I'm a boy, the boy marched into the room, picked up the vase and smashed it against the wall. And he said, now you can write whatever you want. You've dealt with the prompt and you can take it anywhere. And that was just so liberating. And so I train all my students to do that. So we go back over past questions, and the amount of fear they have about deviating from the question is enormous. But once they do that and realize that it's much more interesting for them, and also that the examiner is going to give them marks, they're liberated. To be fair to AQA, they've tried to do that with the picture. So they always give a picture prompt, either to the story or the description. But if it's to the description, the wording is write something suggested by the picture. So they're actually saying to you, you can have some fun with this if you want, whereas most teachers worry that students will fail if they go off-piste And so they train them to describe what is in the picture. And the exam boards say, well, that's not what we want, you know. But it's if you've got the courage as a teacher to do it or as a student, it's much more liberating.
I love that. I think it's brilliant. Break the vase. Fantastic. So, yeah, tell us about paper two. So could you, that was really helpful if you could just walk us through paper two as well, because it's a little bit more tricky, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, so I'm writing, I've just written a guide to every single question. And I've got stuck on question four of paper two because I've tried 12 different permutations of, you know, what are the underlying rules of this question? And I can't solve it. But so we'll leave question four for the minute. So question two, you compare two texts. It's 8 marks. So you've got to write 8 things. And that's where students go wrong. So you've got to write 4 comparisons and have 4 explanations, and that will get you the 8 marks, I think. Now, the reason I'm a bit dodgy on this is it's so artificial that it's really hard to go back and remember what's in every question. But that is a method that does work. Write 8 things and you'll get 8 marks. Question three, I think that's 12 marks, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Shocking, which is basically quote and explain. So, well, there's 12 marks. Guess what? 12 quotes, 12 explanations. Simple as that. Just do it. Make sure you start at the beginning and get to the end so you can show you've read the whole text. So simple. If you can't do all 12, make sure you do the beginning and the end and then as many as you can in the middle. And that also shows you've done the whole text. And that's just bread and butter stuff that kids have been doing since year 5. So it's just stamina, blitz it. You've got 12 marks means you've got 16 minutes. Question four, 16 marks. And there isn't a method to that, not that I've discovered. So you've basically got to write as much as you can in the time. 16 marks is 24 minutes. And I don't have a more insightful way of saying what you've got to do. When you compare, I don't think the examiners care much about the comparison. So they don't count the number of comparisons you make, which is odd because they're asking you to compare. They just care about the insight you have in your analysis. And that basically means quote and explain. I do apologize for being so ropey on question four. It's just...
it's a tricky one. Yes.
Yeah. It's only 16 marks. And really, if I said write as much as you can, it's 16 marks because you've got to write 16 points. That will get you the grades. So the topics are deliberately really boring. The kind of superpower revision is... you can predict what the questions are going to be. I mean, last year, I wrote a guide to persuasive writing. It had 11 or 12 grade 9 answers in it, one for each question that I thought could possibly come up. And sure enough, one of them came up in the exam. And I got loads of comments. Oh, I just, you know, I knew exactly what to write. I've already read a grade 9 answer. And you could genuinely do that. You could prepare some answers in advance. You don't have to, though, because let's face it, the questions are going to be so predictable anyway that any student with an ounce of world experience who's ever read a newspaper, you know, who's ever thought about the world beyond the confines of their own life will have lots to say. The key thing is to say it in an emotive way. Again, different word to start every single sentence. Again, chuck in those 5 different pieces of punctuation. The key techniques which reward students a lot in that question are metaphor. So teachers, I think, underteach the use of metaphor. Anecdote. If you ever read any opinion piece in a newspaper, anecdote is probably the first thing the persuasive piece will start with. get used to anecdote, and then get rid of the fake stuff, like fake statistics, fake experts, because although they'll make sense to the student, they will inevitably write something that is absurd to the adult marking it. So, so do not bother with any statistics or quotations from experts. Just rely on the other techniques. I teach my students 15 different techniques. Most schools teach something called Daforest, which has only got 8. The main technique that the Greeks used was repetition. So in rhetoric, there were 15 different kinds of repetition. It's only mentioned once in most teachers' teaching. And so you can have a lot of fun by just finding different ways to repeat things. One of the easiest ways to learn that sort of persuasive writing is to list, let's say, 12 techniques and use them in an arbitrary way. So every sentence, put in a different technique. When you start that, you don't write the best piece because it doesn't flow as well. But what you'll find after you've done it about 3 times is you'll be so switched on to what the techniques are that it then becomes second nature, and it's easy to then write a flowing piece which is crammed full of techniques which are appropriate to what you're arguing about. So that was a long and rambly way of telling you how to do question 5.
Got a great way of remembering those techniques, haven't you? Mad Father's crotch, is it?
Yes. So most teachers are very upset about the crotch, even though it's spelt C-R-O-C-H, and they desperately try to change the anagram, which is fine. But my research on memory says that the more ridiculous or memorable the mnemonic is, the more it'll stick in memory. So I do stick to Mad Father's crotch.
And so that stands for metaphor, alliteration, all those
yes,
different things.
Yes, how many can you do?
Oh, gosh.
No, don't worry.
So, I know that my son writes it down as soon as he gets in so that he can kind of tick them off.
So in class, I do a competition where the students have to list them in order. And we time them and they go up against each other every few weeks just to keep it fresh. And I think my record is 6 seconds for a kid being able to enunciate everything clearly and accurately in the right order. So the things that are in it that most students don't bother with is metaphor, anecdote, humour, hyperbole. Those are the ones that are quite big. That students just aren't used to using. Others are like, you know, alliteration, simile. Oh, gosh, all the predictable stuff, you know, repetition. Oh, contrasting pairs is something else that teachers don't teach, where, you know, you present on the one hand this, but on the other hand that. That sort of contrast and juxtaposition is something that good persuasive writers use all the time. And also creating an enemy rather than just having emotive language, you go overboard in demonizing the position that you disagree with. It's just, I find it loads of fun. And if you, in class, what I do is I'll say to the kids, right, the next one, because we just follow it through, the next one is metaphor. You've got 1 minute to carry on your piece of writing using a metaphor. And they scribble away madly for 1 minute. Right, finish the sentence you're on. Okay, the next one is direct address. Keep writing for 1 minute. You can use anything you want, but you have to include direct address, go, and so on. And they get through all 15 techniques in 15 minutes, which is really high-value revision.
Yes.
And then they get to redraft and think, well, you know, what will I move about? What will I delete? What am I left with? How can I improve it?
One thing I wanted to ask you was, what would you suggest for pupils that are dyslexic, because English is particularly challenging for pupils who are dyslexic?
Yeah, I'm going to answer this in a number of ways with an apology to parents of dyslexic kids. But I've got a dyslexic daughter who trained as an English teacher, you know, and she still makes mistakes on the board, and it's just part of the learning process. And so I refuse to get her diagnosed. My neighbour, same age, he did get diagnosed, He ended up having to retake his A-levels. Very bright kid, doing fantastically well in his job now. He's 26. The label for him just held him back because he had an excuse for why he wasn't doing well. And so what I say to kids is, you know, let's imagine you wanted to run a marathon, but you're fat. Yeah, you've got that inherent disadvantage. You just got to work harder than someone who isn't fat, but you will overcome the disadvantage. And it's the same with dyslexia. Loads of the research into dyslexia says the effects of dyslexia, no different from kids who have had a hearing impairment when they were young and have therefore not understood the building blocks of sound, and that's held back their development. So if you think about that, what it says is if you spend years trying to overcome the disadvantage of dyslexia, you'll be able to do it. Interestingly, because students with dyslexia struggle with the minutiae of reading and sound pattern recognition and stuff, they develop a load of strengths about seeing the bigger picture and wider connections. And so once they overcome the detail part, they're actually better equipped, you know, because yes, they've learned the really hard bit of mastering the detail, but they've also got all this other hinterland of ways to connect stuff.
Well, we have a series of questions that we ask all of our guests, so I'd like to fire them at you now, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
They are, what would be two things you would tell? We normally say your 18-year-old self, if you had the chance, but for you, I'm going to ask your 16-year-old self, seeing as we're talking so much about exams and GCSEs.
Yeah, so okay, the one thing I didn't know when I was 16 is that revision isn't about effort. It's about spacing and challenge. And so I revised really hard from the beginning of April all the way up to my exams. And what I didn't realize is I could revise much less hard if I started my revision 2 years earlier and just did it in 10-minute chunks. And so all the cognitive science around space learning and interleaving and retrieval practice, if I'd known that, I would have worked a lot less hard and got much higher results.
So what are three things that you love to do every day? What gives you a great start and end to the day or routine to the day?
So coffee addiction. Mm-hmm. So I have three or four coffees a day, no matter what. But not first thing. So the idea is that your body is geared up to flood you with all kinds of forms of pleasure just by virtue of waking up. So don't have your first coffee before 10. I always, nearly always do some exercise. I know it doesn't show. I've put on a stone over Easter. It's very depressing. But always do some exercise because it's not just great for the body but also for the mind. And I always try and do something creative. So, you know, it can be writing, it can be videoing. And there's a number four is I get quite lost in my own head. I just love ideas and thinking. And so I've given myself a motto of people before paper. And so I always try and seek out some sort of meaningful conversation in the day that isn't just chit-chat. And I'm useless at the chit-chat stuff. I want to have conversations that are going to change the way I think about the world. And so I'm always after that sort of conversation.
That's a great goal to have every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would be your one piece of advice you'd give to somebody who's worried about their exams?
It's like they don't matter. And that's really hard to think of in the moment. But if you've got any ounce of perspective about life outside of the UK, you know, you see people struggling enormously to make ends meet or to get an education. And it's so easy to realize what advantages we have. And we have so many first world problems. And as soon as you step out of that, you realize that it's a nonsense. And, you know, if you want to do well in this country, it's almost impossible not to. Whereas in other countries, you know, if you're suffering from poverty or war, what have you, it doesn't matter how brilliant you are. It's really hard to lift yourself out of that. Here, you have to choose not to succeed in life, because if you just turn up every day to school, you will learn plenty to get through the exams. So I'll give you, I told you I'm data obsessive. My school's very white, working class. So in terms of prior attainment, kids come with much lower grades than national average. But kids who have 95% attendance or more got nearly a grade higher in every single one of their subjects. So they turned up.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's lots of other great stuff we're doing as a school, but if you turn up and just pay attention every day, treat education as a privilege rather than a punishment, you'll fly. They genuinely will fly, despite everything I've said about schools becoming too much like an exam factory and so on. So just, you know, turn up, pay attention, and everything else will flow. Outside of that, have stuff that teaches you how to follow your passion. So with our kids, I looked at, like, what makes kids happy? I looked around school, and it's sport, except football and dance. It's music, except the drums. So I just chucked my kids at every sporting and musical experience I could, and thought, well, which ones are going to stick? And, you know, what they didn't like, they dropped, and they took up other stuff. And they learned through that that perseverance equals success. You know, I can't play this musical instrument, so I practice. Oh, now I can do it. Like, it's like it's that light bulb moment. I practice, I put in effort, I get better. I get feedback on what I'm doing wrong, I change it, I get better. And sport is exactly the same. And I got my kids into that for those life lessons. And my subjective view, those kids are happier. You know, when you look around a school, who are the happy kids? It's kids who know that failure is a necessary part of success, but also a corollary to enjoyment. Because when you overcome something that was difficult, you inherently feel much better about yourself. So why Yes. wouldn't we seek out experiences that help us find difficulties to overcome? So, you know, sport and music, I did that constantly. Neither of them play any music, but they still do loads of sport.
It's brilliant. 100% agree with you on that. Yeah. And it's just finding the joy in it, isn't it, really?
Exactly.
Yes. And it has been an absolute joy talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time and for everything that you do for kids in helping them and making it a much more pleasant experience going through this exam process.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me. It's very rare I get a chance just to talk about myself. So thank you very much as well.
You can read more about Mr. Salis and pick up lots of his advice on the Birmingham Live website and on the Brummie Mummies Facebook page. And you can watch his videos on his YouTube channel, Mr. Salis Teaches English. His books on Shakespeare, poetry, English language and literature are available on Amazon. Brummie Mummies is a laudable production. You can download or stream episodes every fortnight on all major podcasting platforms. Please share this episode with anyone who you think might find it useful. You may also want to check out our episodes on the three questions to ask on Parents' Evening. That's with head teacher Raj Mann. Why dyslexia is a superpower with Kate Griggs. And finding balance when revising with teacher Nicola Lepage. Be sure to follow Brummie Mummies on social media and sign up to our newsletter. See you next time.